Sunday, October the 8th. Looked forward to with much hard work and a rising ripple of apprehension right below the surface. Dawn clear and bright. Actually, an hour's in energy spent. It was one of the most civilized days of a trip I've had. But in the sheer batterings of emotions, it was pretty wearing. Liz and I left the White House a little past 10, and at National Airport met the Lennons with their son, got into their plane, which the Lawrence Rockefellers share, and flew to an airport in North Adams, Massachusetts. One of the pleasantest rides I can remember. Mr. Lennon told us about his trips with businessmen to many European and Eastern countries. Russia was among them. He was most interesting, and so was his wife. The mayor greeted us, I was given a key, and we went quickly on into Williamstown, a picture postcard New England city. The streets elm-lined, a white-spired church, the mountains around turning gold and crimson with autumn. Sawyer's residence was a lovely white house built in about 1801. And the Sawyers themselves, quietly pleasant, a bit restrained, completely suited to the college, to the environment. They were hosting a luncheon for 60 people, the degreed recipients, the trustees, some of the faculty. They took me around to meet everyone, and then very soon we sat down. I was on President Sawyer's right and next to a very interesting man, Hugh Bullock, a financier of New York. I gathered he was the chief trustee, who told me about a forum he'd conducted for years, composed of 100 or so Wall Street men, to which they'd invited all sorts of foreign chiefs of state or high officials of this country for a quiet, off-the-record speech and question and answers. He was quite outspoken in his approval of Lyndon. And that was one of the last words of approval I was to hear that day. A little past 2, I put on my black robe with a white velvet front the University of Texas had given me, and joined Dr. Sawyer on the front steps for pictures. And then, out under the trees, we waited for the procession to start. They're always thrilling, and I feel utterly foreign to them, no matter how many I participate in. There were the crimson gowns of Harvard, and a deep blue was Yale, I believe, and the medieval crushed velvet cap that I think comes from English schools is not my milieu. We marched in dignified double file, eyed by President Sawyer, down the quiet streets to Chapin Hall. Within a few steps, I began to size up the crowd. The pickets were there, as promised, but no great number. Printed signs that said, "Confront the War Makers in Washington, October 21," and some others that I couldn't read. They weighed so much on me because of my eyesight, but there were three big homemade ones that were close by, one held by a small boy, and it said, "I am 7 years old. Will I be fighting to protect these present-day pacifists?" And another, a big one, "May God give LBJ strength to continue his courageous stand on the preservation of peace." Another by a silent, stern, youngish man, "I fought in Vietnam, and I believe our cause is just." All of them, anti and pro, walked with me as we maintained our dignified pace to Chapin Hall. And so, of course, did all the cameras. But the most of the crowd were townspeople, bright, smiling children, and their parents, eager to get a look, a wave of excitement going with us as we passed, and apparently completely oblivious of the escort of sign carriers walking behind them. Rather like the Furies in the House of Atreus. We took our seats on the stage, I once more by Mr. Bullock, and as we sang America, I looked out into the audience in front of me. The first several dozen rows were the graduating class in their black robes, and as I saw a white armband on the first one, I was not quite prepared for it, and I felt a quick pulse of emotion in my throat. I counted another and another. The local paper said there were 63 in all. There were 5 of us who received honorary degrees. Besides me, Stanley Kane, Assistant Secretary of the Interior, and President Fairfield Osborne of the New York Zoological Society, and Roger Revelle of the Center for Population Studies at Harvard, and Fraser Darling, Vice President of the Conservation Foundation. All very eminent, lifetime conservationists, masters in their fields, and I a very newcomer. When I was introduced, everybody rose, and it was at this point that some of the graduating class walked out. The local Massachusetts paper said 35. This I had been forewarned about, but the college had its own rebuttals, too, and the townspeople, and it took the form of everybody standing so long and cheering so loudly that their departure was scarcely noticed, and they must have felt rather flat. President Sawyer's citation was deeply thrilling, and I expect it will be more so as I look back on it. and years ahead. He spoke of my quiet leadership and powerful moral support for deeply humane causes ranging from Project Head Start to the quality of the total environment in which we live. And then the dreaded moment, a brief introduction, a present saw you. Citation had been the real introduction. And then the thing I came for, a salute to the Williams College Center for Environmental Studies. I believe I did well. I certainly spoke with passion, and I tried to look straight into the eyes of the students in front of me, one to another, as the speech progressed. It began with a very real praise for a college of Williams caliber, setting up a center for environmental studies. But the lines I liked best were, "There is no time for annotated studies to gather dust on library shelves. While 11,000 city planning positions must be filled in the next 5 years, planning schools are producing only 450 graduates a year. Because what I hope is that they will bridge the gap between the theorizing city planner and the mayor, between the professor and the budget officer." I felt I did well. I seldom feel so. I never tried harder. For that, in part, I can thank the pickets. It was a very quiet, attentive audience, and very loud applause when I sat down. And then how relieved I was, because the real address was a rather lengthy one by Stanley Kane, very erudite and professorial, but I soon found pleasantly spiced with wry humor. The last moment of the convocation was by all odds the most touching. Everybody rose and we sang The Mountains. I did not know it, but I read the words and loved them. And so you felt, did all the students there. Then we filed out. The pickets were still there, but louder now. And a funny thing, as you turned your back and started on up the hill, and they were behind you, the ugly murmur rose in volume, and I heard calls of shame, shame. There's something weird and animal about mob psychology, and I wondered what would have happened if I had suddenly broken into a run. But of course, we maintained our dignified gait and our smiles, and walked under the elms up to the front of the house, where the procession broke up, and I said goodbye to several of the faculty members, and to the high sheriff, one of the most colorful figures of the day, who dressed in swallowtail coat and high silk hat, and carrying a huge staff, had led the procession. He was a tall, impressive man, and to begin it, he had banged on the floor and said, "In the name of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, pray have silence." The presence of the sheriff is a custom begun early in William's day. It was founded in 1783. I changed into flat-heeled shoes and my brown tweed coat, and Professor James McGregor Burns joined me, and we drove out to Mount Hope Farm, which will be the site for the Environmental Planning Center, a sort of a think tank for city planning experts, students, professors. There couldn't have been a more complete change of mood, of atmosphere. It was the most peaceful, quiet, beautiful New England landscape you could imagine. Open meadows rolling away, woods turning scarlet and gold, a ring of blue mountains in the distance, a very heaven of a place to walk, and we did for about an hour and a half. I had been invited to Williams by James McGregor Burns, and it was actually because of him I had decided to come. I liked him, and I applauded what they were doing, the Environmental Center. I wanted to bring whatever little garland of publicity I could. We walked down the country roads between the maples and the pines, and Mr. Burns told me about his race for Congress years ago. The books he was writing, he finished one on FDR. It had taken him 4 years, and he was writing another. I told him I was reading the one on President Kennedy, and found this period, which I had shared from a very different vantage point, most interestingly described. And then I asked him if he planned to write another on the years of Kennedy as president, knowing, even as the words came out of my mouth, that it was the wrong thing to say. No, the family had been very upset. Several of them had come to see him about it. No, he wasn't planning another. He did not think he would get much cooperation. Always in the back of my mind, there is the hope that someone is an historian with a name and who writes well will do a book on Lyndon. None of them so far, with the exception of The Professional by Bill White, have the depth and the quality I hope to see someday. He talked to me about Mount Hope Farm itself. It had been owned by Colonel and Mrs. Prentice. She was a Rockefeller, and I gather probably Lawrence's aunt must have been a generation ahead of him. It had been an experimental farm. Some of the first chickens with extra big breasts had been raised here. About 100 people had worked on it. and the princes themselves had lived in a great red brick house with white pillars and formal Italian gardens that looked strange in this New England setting. We stopped at a lookout and surveyed the valley below and the blue hills in the distance. This country is so beautiful, it has an absolutely caressing quality to me. Then we went back to the house, and it was like stepping into another world, stepping backward in time, how many decades, to something that no longer exists. Dark paneled walls, statues and tapestries that fitted well the tales of the sedate Sunday musicals the family used to give. It was only on the subject of agriculture that Colonel Prentice got enthusiastic. It was like looking into a page of the past, jailed for all time, and I was greatly intrigued. Back at the Sawyer's house, we walked into the warm welcome of a fire, and the crisp chill of the outside heightened our pleasure in it. We sat down and had a drink. And this was another charming side of New England. I loved it, but did not feel the least kinship to it. It was indeed far from the madding crowd. I changed again into another quiet, understated outfit, and we went to the Clark Art Institute, a museum of white marble, which to me seemed quite European and out of keeping in this New England setting, and saw the most marvelous collection of French Impressionist paintings, which had been left by a wealthy collector, Mr. Clark, to this little New England town of 7,000. They told me he'd thought perhaps big centers like New York would be in danger of bombing someday, and his would be safe here, and very much enjoyed and appreciated by the intellectuals of this venerable old college. It was fabulous. 32 Renoirs, sad, amusing Toulouse-Lautrecs, America sat that I would never have recognized, many Degas and statues also, Matisse and Winslow Homer, and much old silver, English silver. The curator, a knowledgeable gentleman with the name of George Heard Hamilton, the only thing about this wonderful museum that the press took note of, interesting commentary on their evaluation of what's important, escorted me through while most of the other guests lingered around the cocktail table in the main room. And finally, we joined them there. It had been sheer pleasure for me, and I was rather pleased that clear across the room a picture would speak to me, and I could say to Mr. Hamilton, "There's another Daumier. That must be a Cezanne." All except Manet. I never recognized him. It was nearly 8 when we went back to the Sawyer's residence. Once more, the fires were bright and welcoming. We sat down to dinner with our attractive daughter Kit, home for the weekend from her teaching job. She was fresh out of college. And Mr. Fraser Darling, one of the degree recipients, the Sheffies, and Undersecretary Kane and Mrs. Kane, Liz and Cynthia and the Sawyers and I. The rooms were furnished rather sparely, with great good taste, beautiful moldings around the ceilings. And you could tell where the original house built in 1801 melted into an addition. Some of the school's own paintings hung on the walls, and in my bedroom there were rather austere twin iron beds. Nothing plush here, but quality and grace in the big living rooms and dining room. I like the Sawyers very much. And how would I evaluate a day spent like this? Probably a mistake on balance, because what I had really done was give a vehicle to the dissenters, who were a minority, to mount a platform to get inches in the paper, minutes on the television screen that they would not, without me, have gotten. So I was their bait, their creature for the day. And what I'd set out to do was to praise Williams for establishing its Center for Environmental Planning. And this, I think I had done. I earnestly feel the speech was good and there was a rapport between me and those in the room. But the louder voice of hate and anger shouted it down. How did I personally feel as I walked among the picketers? Cool and firm and tough, and determined to maintain dignity. But through every pore you sense a sort of an animal passion right below the surface. All in all, I guess I lost this round, but there are pluses. I am glad I came to know better such interesting people as the James Lennons and James McGregor Burns, and to listen to Mr. Hugh Bullock, and to see the whole atmosphere of this little town, the Sawyer's home, the brilliant New England foliage, and the processional so rich with tradition, led off by its high sheriff in his tall silk hat.